Joseph Tracy says of the Great Awakening, that period of revival in the New England colonies in what is now the United States in the 18th century, that it was one of those movements in history in which it was some great idea was then extensively at work, breaking up established and venerated habits of thought, feeling, and action, and producing a revolution in the minds of men, and thus in the very structure of society. The Great Awakening, Tracy demonstrates and documents, is no less revolutionary in New England society. The very categories of thinking and habits of living were deeply and vitally affected by this revival of religion in New England. The great idea to which Tracy attributes this revolutionary change is the idea of the new birth, the idea that a person must be regenerated, that there must be a change in their heart concomitant with saving grace, and that this regeneration is such that a person who has been born again may generally and normally be distinguished from someone who has not. That is, that this regeneration causes a discernible change and gives rise to certain discernible characteristics that generally accompany what is biblically described as a Christian walk or a Christian life. This idea of regeneration and the preaching that accompanied it was not, by and large, a currently popular idea before the Great Awakening. It was greatly emphasized during the Great Awakening. It was violently opposed by the Awakening's opposition. It was zealously supported by the Awakening's proponents. And as Tracy demonstrates, this was evidently the right key, for it fitted all the wards of the complicated lock. Now, as we examine the Great Awakening, we'll be looking at several facets of this powerful movement. We'll first set the stage by examining the theological and the ecclesiastical context from which this movement sprang forth. We'll want to examine more carefully the significance of this central idea so powerful in the movement, the idea of the new birth. And we'll also want to examine the movement from the perspective of several of its key players, particularly George Whitefield, Gilbert Tennent, and Jonathan Edwards. And then we'll look briefly at the movement itself and its contributions to the history of the church. Now, by the time you get to the 1730s and the 1740s, the Puritanism of nearly a century before had undergone some significant changes. As the spirit of Puritanism passed from generation to generation, we find that certain accommodations were made. In the early days of New England, in that grand experiment of God's rule among his covenant people, there were none but church members who could hold office or vote in elections. And given what they were attempting to accomplish, understandably so. But it was not too long before they introduced this notion, which we'll look at in some detail in a moment, called the halfway covenant, in which someone who is a child of believing parents and come of age may in fact vote and hold office, receive the church sacraments, that is, baptism for their children and the Lord's Supper, even if they have not come to experience or give testimony to the conversion of the new birth. Now, to set this within the theological context of the doctrine of the covenant in Puritan theology, the covenant people of God were the ones who by God, had the right to rule over the covenant community and not unbelievers. They were very concerned that their civil government be a biblical one and that their magistrates be Christian. And theologically, The covenant was held to be made with not only God's faithful, believing, regenerate people, but also with their infant children, so that on that grounds the infant children of believers might receive the sacrament of baptism. When the child grew old enough to consciously reject God's covenant and show outwardly the fruits of his lack of regeneration, he is said to become a covenant breaker and in need of God's regenerating hand upon his life in order to be reintroduced into the covenant people of God. Theologically, they recognized that some children, as they grow, may in fact be regenerated before they show any great outward signs of their unregenerate state, while many will not be regenerated by God until after they have shown those outward signs of their rebellion against him. As time progressed, the intense spiritual diligence with which the first generation Puritans labored to instruct, encourage, and admonish their children in the fear of the Lord grew somewhat abated, and the number of children who grew up in the church without showing any sign of spiritual regeneration or even profession of the possession of that new birth, yet also they're not showing any great outward immorality or any great outward profession of terrible heresy, that number of people grew larger and larger. And it was for this group of people that the halfway covenant was devised, so that those who have grown up in the church and have have yet not necessarily any evidence of the new birth, yet still no terrible gross immoralities, they may by that halfway covenant be included in the governmental process of God's covenant people. This, in one sense, was the English Puritans' answer, although it came somewhat later, to the Continental Covenant theology's emphasis on the covenant as an external bond of the people of God, as opposed to the first generation Puritans' emphasis on internalizing that covenant. And it's beyond our scope here, but perhaps we'll explore that in a little more detail at another time. This had its outworkings in the administration of the sacraments, particularly of the Lord's Supper. Within the English church, a person who was appointed to any civil or military office had to qualify for that office by partaking of the Lord's Supper in the established church. Now remember, theirs was the Erastian system of church government, in which the head of the state was also the head of the church, and ecclesiastical offices were also viewed as civil offices. In fact, if a clergyman in the Church of England were to withhold the elements of the Lord's table from someone who requested it, that was considered a civil crime and was liable to civil prosecution. And that clergyman, if he was so prosecuted, would have to demonstrate before the court that he had very good grounds for withholding the Lord's Supper from this person, or he would suffer the consequences of his civil crime. But in fact, many people seeking office in the state would qualify themselves for that office by receiving the Lord's Supper, and yet neglect it the rest of their lives. It was merely a form necessary to the attainment of their civil position. And this particular way of administering the ordinance fits within the Anglican scheme of baptismal regeneration. That is, when a person is baptized, they're incorporated into the church, they are regenerated by their baptism, and only a gross evidence of apostasy would warrant withholding from them the Lord's table. Unfortunately, we also find this increasing laxness and lowering of standards for participation in the covenant community also took place in Scotland, where they did not believe in baptismal regeneration, but were committed to the notion of what's called presumptive regeneration, saying that we must presume a child within the covenant community to be regenerate until they prove otherwise. Not that they are regenerate by baptism, not that they possess regeneration necessarily. We do not know. In fact, we cannot know. All we can do is treat them as though they are regenerate, presumptive regeneration. As Tracy has said, in order to render such hopes possible, it must be held, this is a key point, it must be held that the difference between the regenerate and others is not apparent to men. That regeneration, ordinarily at least, produces no apparent change. That is, if regeneration is always invisible and does not have a discernible effect on a person, ordinarily, and that those who are discernibly affected are only the extraordinary cases, then the Scottish administration of the ordinance, following the same pattern of the Anglican, would then fit within their covenant theology. Well, for the ministers of the Great Awakening, there was a problem that they discerned in a church that had gradually lost its life, lost its vitality, largely because of this practical application of doctrine within the church. Alan Simpson has even gone so far as to say that we are hardly surprised to learn that the halfway covenant was in most cases a halfway house between a church from which all but the saint had been excluded and one in which all but the flagrant sinner was admitted. Samuel Danforth, the Massachusetts minister, bewailed this tendency as early as 1671. He asks, "Doth not a careless, remiss, flat, dry, cold, dead frame of spirit grow in upon us secretly, strangely, prodigiously?" This was the creeping condition that in fact led to the deadness in the church discovered by men such as Whitfield, Edwards, and Tennant. As Tracy summarizes the Great Awakening's understanding of the minister's responsibility in preaching, he says that impenitence, unbelief, enmity to God, and whatever other sins are implied in these might be, and in Christian faithfulness must be, charged home upon hearers who would know themselves to be the persons intended and would confess that the preacher only did his duty. The preachers of the Great Awakening, looking around them and seeing a mostly dead church, saw their biblical duty to preach the gospel as to men who were in need of the gospel. That where they saw no sign of spiritual life, they felt they could no longer keep up the charade of treating dead men as though they were alive. But before God, they had to proclaim the truth that would transform the unbelieving heart by the Holy Spirit's working in a regenerate heart. Shortly after the beginning of the 18th century, a debate was engaged via published sermons between the venerable Mr. Stoddard of Northampton and Dr. Increase Mather. Stoddard maintained not only that sanctifying grace was not necessary for a person rightly to partake of the Lord's Supper, but even spoke of, quote, "the right of visible saints to the Lord's Supper, though they be destitute of a saving work of God's Spirit on their hearts." He argued intensely against Increase Mather, contending that anyone in the visible church, which, remember, at that time effectively meant anyone born in England, should be given the Lord's Supper when they desired it, regardless of whether they gave any evidence whatsoever or even profession of a work of saving grace in their hearts. He spoke, in fact, of the Lord's Supper as a converting ordinance and came very near to the Roman principle of ex operato. Increase Mather, on the other hand, replied against Stoddard and abhorred this approach to the sacraments, But Stoddard's influence helped greatly to establish this loose administration of the ordinance in many parts of New England. So, via the halfway covenant in the colonies, as well as the more Anglican arguments of men like Stoddard, we find shortly after the turn of the century that the sacrament of the Lord's Supper was being freely administered to unregenerate. And the sacrament of baptism was being administered to the infant children of second-generation Puritans who were themselves confessedly unregenerate. As Tracy emphasizes, one obvious tendency of this practice was to destroy church discipline. For unconverted members generally would not be strict in calling others to account for errors of doctrine or practice. But this prostration of discipline was not the worst evil to which this practice tended. What must it teach the unconverted church member to think of himself and his prospects for eternity? He was, according to this doctrine, pursuing the very course which God had prescribed for such persons as himself, and believing this, he could not think himself very deep in guilt or very greatly in danger. Such a man could not feel very strongly his need of conversion, says Tracy. Now, it is true, and we must recognize that Stoddard himself was a faithful preacher of the truth, and in his preaching he did much practically to counterbalance the injurious effects of his ecclesiastical practice. But we must recognize the fundamental contradiction between the doctrines that he preached and the doctrines which were implied and perceived in his system of administrating the sacraments. He and others like him tried to avoid seeing the contradiction and tried to believe both at the same time. Well, then you add to that a creeping tendency towards Arminianism, both in the colonies as well as in England, in the feeling that those who are unconverted can rightly and should rightly, without any supernatural aid or work of grace, begin a series of works designed to prepare them to conversion, and that those who are doing those things are doing what they ought to do and were not in any grave danger. And add to that as well the increase of unconverted men entering the ministry of the church, which fact was quite openly recognized by Stoddard and others, Stoddard even advocating that unconverted ministers may rightly perform certain ministerial duties, you see that the spiritual state of the church, both in the colonies and in England, fell to a deplorable new low. From the baptismal regeneration of the Church of England, as well as the halfway covenant in the colonies, the same practical result came about on both sides of the Atlantic. A church filled largely with unregenerate, spiritually dead people who had no understanding that that was a problem. The clergy of the church in large numbers were utterly unfit for their offices and were simply earning a living as a minister, just as they might have any other sort of job in the realm. You know, you're a plumber, I'm a minister. Yeah. It was against this depressing backdrop that George Whitefield came upon the scene. And we come now to George Whitefield. In talking about the Great Awakening and the revival of true religion in England and New England at that time, J.C. Ryle says that of the men involved in that great outpouring of the Spirit, quote, "the first and foremost whom I will name is the well-known George Whitefield, though not the first in order. If we look at the date of his birth, I place him first in the order of merit without any hesitation." He was born in Gloucester in 1714. The town that produced several other giants in church history, not least among them are William Tyndale and Bishop Hooper. He had humble beginnings. There were no rich or powerful family to pave the way for him. His mother ran the Bell Inn there in Gloucester. She didn't seem to make a great profit at it. As a boy, He did have some wrestling matches with his conscience, but he confesses that generally he won. As to the pattern of his young life, he confesses that until he was 15, he was, quote, addicted to lying, filthy talking, and foolish jesting, that he was a Sabbath breaker, a theater goer, a card player, and a romance reader.
Oh. The trifecta.
Okay.
The bottom line of all this being that he did not have a controlling interest in the things of God. He attended the Free Grammar School of Gloucester until he was 15, and he apparently didn't do too badly since he had no trouble afterwards entering university at the age of 18. The one thing we do know about his early school days is that he was even then noted for his good memory and his excellent speaking voice. It was George that was chosen to recite speeches year after year when the Corporation of Gloucester came to visit the grammar school. At 15, he went to work for his mother at the Bell Inn, probably due to her financial struggles at that time. "I put on my blue apron," he says, "washed cups, cleaned rooms, and in a word became a professed common drawer for nigh a year and a half." Well, finally his mother got rid of the inn altogether, and George set his sights on the possibility of going to Oxford. Several providential circumstances overcame his financial inability, and at length George found himself an Oxford student at the age of 18. At Oxford, his early religious convictions grew into a strong Christianity. He frequented all the available means of grace, and he became a member of that famous Holy Club, where he rubbed shoulders with men like John Wesley and his brother Charles and James Hervey, the author of Theron and Aspasio. They had a strict method of living, which earned them the name Methodists. For a while, he seemed perhaps to have gone a bit too far, almost summing up the whole of Christianity in a mystic, ascetic self-denial. He says, "I always chose the worst sort of food. I fasted twice a week. My apparel was mean. I thought it unbecoming a penitent to have his hair powdered. I wore woolen gloves, a patched gown, and dirty shoes. And though I was convinced that the kingdom of God did not consist in meat and drink, yet I resolutely persisted in these voluntary acts of self-denial because I found in them great promotion of the spiritual life." Well, fortunately, he was rescued from his excesses, partly by reading several books, among them Baxter's Call to the Unconverted and Aline's Alarm to Unconverted Sinners, partly with the help of a few concerned, experienced Christians who helped him along, but mostly by simply opening his eyes to the Bible. "I began to read the Holy Scriptures on my knees," he says, "laying aside all other books and praying over, if possible, every line and word. I got more true knowledge from reading the Book of God in 1 month than I could ever have acquired from all the writings of men." J.C. Ryle says of him, "Once taught to understand the glorious liberty of Christ's gospel, Whitfield never turned again to asceticism, legalism, mysticism, or strange views of Christian perfection. The experience received by bitter conflict was most valuable to him. The doctrines of free grace, once thoroughly grasped, took deep root in his heart, and became, as it were, bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. Of all the little band of Oxford Methodists, none seem to have got hold so soon of clear views of Christ's gospel as he did, and none kept it so unwaveringly to the end." Whitfield's theology from this point was decidedly and markedly reformed. Whitfield was called to the ministry from a fairly early age, and Bishop Benson of Gloucester ordained him in 1736 at the age of 21, at a time when ordination was usually withheld until the age of 23. Well, Whitfield was reticent at first, doubting his own fitness for the ministry. He insisted he needed more time for preparation. He had only one sermon, and he was so disappointed in that he loaned it to a neighboring minister to read as proof that he was not suited for the ministry. Well, the minister kept that sermon for 2 weeks, preached it to his own congregation in 2 installments, and gave it back to Whitfield with a half a guinea for its use. Whitfield was reluctant, but the encouragement of numerous mature Christian friends, as well as the inner call of God upon him, finally prevailed. When Whitfield preached his first sermon, some complained to the bishop that he'd driven 15 people mad by that sermon. The bishop replied that he just wished the madness would not be forgotten before the next Sunday. Whitfield finished his Bachelor of Arts degree at Oxford and began preaching at the Tower Chapel in London, and he preached during this time at numerous London churches. From the very beginning, he was a very effective and popular preacher. J.C. Ryle mentions one possible cause that, quote, "the plain truth is that a really eloquent, extempore preacher preaching the pure gospel with most uncommon gifts of voice and manner was at that time an entire novelty in London. The congregations were taken by surprise and carried by storm." He spent some time preaching amongst poor and illiterate folk in Hampshire, and he was soon invited to visit Georgia, a colony in North America, and to help with an orphan house there near Savannah. He sailed to America in 1757, staying there about a year, and when he returned to England, he soon discovered that he had since fallen from favor amongst the ruling portion of the church. Most of the clergy were now suspicious of Whitfield, thinking him rather a fanatic, and particularly one facet of his preaching disturbed them very greatly. That was that Whitfield had the audacity to preach the doctrine of regeneration, or the new birth, as something which was needed by many baptized church members. And this, in the context of England's teaching of baptismal regeneration, you see, was a great insult indeed. How audacious to say to a member of the Church of England, "You must be born again." Whitfield found that churches no longer welcomed him in their pulpits. While the people would hear him gladly, the priests, the prelates, the church wardens denied him access. This cold shoulder turned out to be a fortuitous turn of events, for it sent Whitfield into the fields and the meadows to begin his practice of open-air preaching. In April of 1739, he had gone to preach at Islington for his friend Mr. Stonehouse, who was the vicar there. In the midst of the prayer, he was approached by the church wardens and asked to show his license to preach in the Diocese of London. Of course, Whitfield didn't have such a license any more than any other clergyman who was not regularly stationed in that diocese. So, not licensed, not accredited, he was forbidden by the church wardens to preach from the pulpit. So he left the building and preached in the courtyard. As Whitfield himself recounts, "God was pleased to assist me in preaching, and so wonderfully to affect the hearers that I believe we could have gone singing hymns to prison. Let not the adversaries say I have thrust myself out of their synagogues. No, they have thrust me out." And it is precisely because of that idea of the new birth that he was thrust out. So as Whitfield went into the highways and the hedges, compelling men to the kingdom, he found a ready reception among the colliers, the coal miners near Bristol. "Having no righteousness of their own to renounce," Whitfield recounts, "they were glad to hear of a Jesus who was a friend to publicans and came not to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. The first discovery of their being affected was the sight of the white gutters made by their tears, which plentifully fell down their black cheeks as they came out of their coal pits. Hundreds of them were soon brought under deep conviction, which, as the event proved, happily ended in a sound and thorough conversion, says Whitfield. Well, the Lord was greatly blessing his word. And Whitfield found ready audiences among many hearers, poor and uneducated throughout England. Whitfield was enabled to reach many, many people who otherwise would not have darkened the doorway of a church. This blessing of God on Whitfield's preaching was not well received by the established church. From this time, in fact, Whitfield's preaching from the pulpits of the Church of England ceased almost entirely. He was no longer welcome there. He did not reject the Church of England. He used her prayer book. He agreed with her articles. But the church was not ready for a man like Whitfield, and since it rejected him, it lost the services of one of the greatest men of the century. As J.C. Ryle says, the church was too much asleep to understand him, and was vexed at a man who would not keep still and let the devil alone. From this time to the end of his life, Whitfield was preaching constantly. In his short 34-year ministry, he preached publicly some 18,000 times. He visited Scotland 14 times. He crossed the Atlantic no less than 7 times. He preached to thousands in Boston, Philadelphia, New York, greatly influencing the Great Awakening. He went to Ireland twice and was once nearly killed by a Roman Catholic mob in Dublin. He averaged preaching about 13 sermons a week, and yet found time in the midst of this to write some 1,400 letters. An unfortunate facet of his life was his marriage, which was not a happy one. He left no children, save those thousands of spiritual children which he begat through his preaching. He was active preaching to the very end of his days, and he died very suddenly, stricken by a fit of asthma one night, almost before his friends even knew that he was sick. In his last sermon before he died, friends noted that he did not look well, and it seems that he had some warning of his coming death, for in that sermon he said, "I go to a rest prepared. My sun has given light to many, but now it is about to set." No, to rise to the zenith of immortal glory. How willingly would I live forever to preach Christ, but I die to be with him. But if I leave now, while so few care about heavenly things, the God of peace will surely visit you. And before 6 o'clock the next morning, he was dead. Whitfield provided for evangelicals of all ages a tremendous example in his doctrine, in his preaching, and in his life. These three facets of the ministry must all be straight and true in a faithful minister. Sadly, so many fall short in at least one of these three areas, but Whitfield excelled in them all. His doctrine was crystal clear, and he was one of the first preachers of the 18th century to drink deeply from the old font of those doctrinal truths that had made for the Protestant Reformation. His doctrine was straight as an arrow, and he understood the biblical doctrinal foundation of the gospel that he preached far better than did many of his contemporaries, even those famous men of the old Oxford Holy Club. In his personal life and walk before the Lord, he was noted for his deep humility, which quality he shared with so many other great men as Baxter and Bunyan and Brainerd and McShane and others. We find so often that those men who walk nearest to God walk most humbly. His deep, abiding, burning love to the Lord was evident to all, and he was noted for his diligence in serving his master. As Henry Venn truthfully said in a funeral sermon for him, "One cannot but stand amazed that his mortal frame could, for the space of near 30 years, without interruption, sustain the weight of them," that is, his diligent efforts for his labors for the kingdom. "The truth is," says Vane, "that in point of labor, this extraordinary servant of God did as much in a few weeks as most of those who exert themselves are able to do in the space of a year." Now, I think we're going to leave him right here. We'll pick up with him again next time. We're not finished with Whitfield, but we'll pick up with him again next week, and then carry on to Tennant and Edwards, and then the rest of the awakening.